Good morning. While everyone is settling in, I will make a few announcements, including calling the case. This is the third oral argument on our calendar today, Tuesday, September 19th, 2023. And the case is A230473 in the matter of the trust agreement of Genevieve M. Russo. Counsel, just a few words before you begin your arguments this morning. Appellant will have 15 minutes to present argument. I did overhear that attorneys for respondents intend to split their time this morning, 7.5 minutes each. Then appellant will have the opportunity to present a 5-minute rebuttal. We'll be keeping track of your time for you on the light panel at the podium. Please be mindful, especially since you're splitting your time, of sort of where you're at timing-wise. The arguments this morning are being live-streamed, and we're also making an audio recording. The audio recording will be available shortly on our website. In order to ensure the quality of that audio recording, I just ask that you please identify yourself and the party you're representing before you proceed with your argument this morning. The podium in the middle is also adjustable. Please take your time and get comfortable before you begin presenting your arguments. And I will now turn things over to counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. I'm John Dignan, and with me today is Chris Brown from the Taft Law Firm, and we represent Lee Russo in this matter. This is a case that I think is pretty thoroughly briefed, but it surrounds the whole issue of whether a trust is given effect based on the plain meaning of the wording of the trust. We submit it must be as a matter of law. It hasn't happened yet. This is a case that really started in essence with the trust being drawn in August of 2008 with Jenny Russo, the deceased wife of Lee Russo. They signed a trust agreement. And unfortunately, Jenny died on August 30th, 2014. The trust was drawn by Mr. Earl Cohen, a very well-experienced trust and estates lawyer who did testify in this case, and we'll talk about him shortly. The key parts of the trust that are at issue here, because we're here on a petition for the removal of the two respondents as trustees.
Mr. Dignan, could I have you jump to that issue? And it's actually issue two, as you identified in your brief. Would it be safe for me to say that you did not cite any legal authority for the proposition that your client may discharge, as a trustee, may discharge another trustee without following the fiduciary standard?
That's true. It's based upon what I'd call almost overwhelming facts in this case as to what the intent of the trust testator, Jenny, was. And that law is supported, that you follow the intent.
And so, and there's nothing in the trust that says, the settlers said when the trust was created, the words of the trust that would allow him to do so without following a fiduciary standard.
Well, the wording of it in itself, I guess, Your Honor, is that my spouse shall have the power to remove any trustee.
Right, and that's why I wanted to jump to the how, not that he could. I don't think there's a dispute. I didn't see it that the trust says that.
True.
Your error that you're raising today is the district court required that it be done within a fiduciary standard and made specific findings that it was not. So what I'm trying to understand is what legal authority would we have to say that was an error?
Well, because the cases such as In re Arendt talk about giving effect to the intent of the trust. And when there's an ambiguity, which is being essentially argued here, whether they call it an ambiguity argument or not, we say it's clear. As a spouse, he's able to remove it, and it's under Article 7, not Article 8, which is the fiduciary duties section. They say, no, it means independent trustee you can remove. That's not what it says, but that's why we were able to call in, as a matter of law, we were allowed to do that, call in Earl Cohen to talk about and testify, and the judge found a testimony to be trustworthy.
But you're arguing it's unambiguous, and for our discussion right now, I'm going to agree with you.
Right.
So my question, though, still isn't that he doesn't have that authority. The question is, on what legal basis, by looking at that plain language and giving effect, how did the court not give effect to that by requiring that he comply with a fiduciary standard?
Again, because it was written as a spouse. And the benefit of having Earl Cohen's testimony is that he's able to testify about what the intent, the specific intent by Jenny was.
Well, that's what I'm at a loss. What legal authority would support the notion that because she said spouse rather than his name means he can act in any capacity as a trustee without following a fiduciary standard?
With respect to removal of any trustee, the intent, as testified to by Earl Cohen, was that she didn't want him to be held to that standard specifically. He testified to that, and that's uncontradicted testimony by Earl Cohen, a very well-respected trust and estates lawyer.
So I'm just uncontradicted. Over that, would you agree that in order to get to that and for that to be relevant to our consideration, it would have to be ambiguous? If the language is unambiguous and the case law, both in the trust and estate, is pretty clear, it says what it says, so we don't have to look at anything else for interpretation.
Yes, and in fact, either way, we prevail. But because it's so clear, they have to concede that he doesn't have to be a trustee to be able to remove the other trustees. If he was no longer a trustee, he had power as her spouse to remove any of the other trustees. Period. That's the reading of the trust. And in fact, I believe it's conceded by the other side that, well, yeah, if he wasn't trustee, he'd have that. It doesn't change. In other words, it's clear that he has the power as a spouse to remove any trustee. That's the four corners of the document. Is what it says. There's no qualifications, and
just
again,
to be clear, though,
yes,
he was a co-trustee.
At the time, he was. Yes, true. There isn't any basis for not allowing it to be removed. That's really, I don't think there's any true evidence in this case, in the action, that in any way doesn't allow him to remove the two respondents.
Well, the difference, other than the fiduciary standard, right? I mean, that's what the judge really relied on in her decision. And your point being is simply that because she said spouse, he's not bound by a fiduciary standard as a co-trustee. And that's how you would ask me to plainly read it, and that's the error.
And the fact that what she uses as a basis, that is this 2018 stipulation, that's unenforceable. One, because it was only during the pendency of the stay is when he agreed not to remove any of the trustees. That case was settled in January of 2019. There was a release and settlement agreement signed, and nothing was said whatsoever about the trust itself in that settlement. Nor was there any attempt formally to modify the trust to make it comply with that. And the case is now closed. The case was dismissed. It's closed. It's no longer in effect. And it was clear by the very nature of it that it was temporary in any event. So that was really the basis for her saying, gee, I don't think you have a right to do that because of the 2018 stipulation, unenforceable. And under 501C.0411, there was no modification because it wasn't done in accordance with that statute. So there was no modification. The trust itself governs. The clear wording of the trust governs. And so the basis for saying that, gee, he breaches fiduciary duty because of that stipulation, that was long gone. That was in 2019 when the case was closed. That's over. That's no longer in effect in any way, shape, or form. It was subsumed by the release, which dismissed the case.
I want to take you back, Mr. Dignan.
Sure.
Looking at Article 7 of the trust agreement, the 7.4.3, which has been the crux of your argument thus far, and I understand Mr. Cohen's testimony, and that's certainly something that you use in support of your argument specifically. But as respondents argue, the last paragraph of that particular article uses the conjunctive term "and." So the first sentence, says, my spouse shall have the power to remove any trustee, and the court shall appoint a successor to any independent trustee so removed.
Right.
Respondents, of course, read that to mean Mr. Russo has the authority under this as spouse to remove an independent trustee, and then the court is involved in the appointment of a successor. Could you respond directly to that?
Absolutely, yes. Thank you. In fact, that paragraph is very clear because it says he as the spouse can remove any trustee, not any independent trustee, and then it has a comma, but it's basically a but rather than and the court shall appoint an independent trustee because that's the terms of the trust are that the court is the one that has to appoint the trustee, the independent trustee, unless these two respondents have appointed one, and they never did. Those are the two bases for appointing an independent trustee under the trust. They agree to do it between themselves under the terms of the trust, or a court has to appoint. And so that it isn't meant to be read together, because if it was really that restrictive, it would have said remove any independent trustee, and then the court has to appoint. So it's clear the intent, and again, if we do look at Earl Cohen's testimony, it's pretty clear that her intent was not to have anyone, particularly the respondents, interfere with running the business as Mr. Rosso had done for many, many, many years successfully. That was her intent. So I don't know if I've answered that question.
Thank you.
Mr. Dignan, on that point, what keeps coming up in my mind when I looked at your argument with that regard, why then did she name the respondents as co-trustees? In other words, that testimony, and I understand it in the record, it didn't quite add up to me, because if she was that concerned, she wouldn't have given that authority to act as co-trustees, so it doesn't really answer anything that's before us today, it seems to me.
Certainly. Thank you, Your Honor. I think that the testimony, again, of Earl Cohen, it makes it clear that, she wanted to appoint them as trustees under a separate section, but she didn't want them interfering with the business or lording it over somehow. So if it became a problem, he had the power. And there was no in perpetuity language, obviously. It was, okay, you can be appointed to replace me, but Mr. Rosso has the power to remove any trustee if he chooses. And it's important because he was the one running the business, started the business along with Jenny. It was important to her that he be able to run that business successfully as he had done along with her for many years.
Could I ask you to jump to the issue of independent trustee?
Yes.
Would you agree the trust itself gives your client no authority to appoint an independent trustee?
True. He can remove one later, but can't appoint. They're just the two purposes that I answered to.
Just stopping at that point, how would it ever be an error for the court to deny your client's appointment of a particular independent trustee? And that's before we even get to the discussion of the order from 2018 that requires that he act in good faith to work with the respondent co-trustees. He just has no authority, so it could never be an error not to. I understand the concern. I assume that everybody has. There isn't one yet, which was what led to the agreement in 2018.
Right.
So that agreement actually gave your something client, your client, something that he doesn't otherwise have. Some say,
well,
and who gets picked as an independent.
Some
trustee.
Say in it, but it only is, you know, he can include it with the petition, but it's still absolutely up to the court. She can deny that. There should be a good basis for it. I don't think there was one, but trustee suggested as...
He made numerous factual findings that he acted in bad faith. Wouldn't that be sufficient good reason to deny his request?
No, and no, I don't think so, but I'm glad that you got to that because I've only got a short period of time left, and I do want to address this bad faith. It is clear error to find bad faith in this case because 549.14 is very clear that it has to be bad faith in the action. That is, did he have a right, a good faith basis, a reasonable basis to file this petition? Answer is clearly yes, of course he did. And in fact, we've obviously litigated it, but that doesn't mean he didn't have a good faith basis to do it because it's completely consistent with the clear wording of the trust. The judge brought in like, oh, well, you didn't comply with the stipulation of 2018. That's irrelevant. It's one, it doesn't have any effect on this, but that is outside of what actions he took here, not outside. And, you know, they try to raise all sorts of bad things. Oh, he did this, that, and the other thing. Oh, we could have done the same thing, but we didn't because the issue is very narrow. Under the trust, can he remove the two respondents? And two, the appointment of the trust of the independent trustee. That's up ultimately to the judge, of course. But, you know, I don't think we want to get into, well, then he'd remove him or her, and then the next one. I mean, so, you know, there has to be some hopefully coming together on it, but certainly the judge has the ultimate decision on the trust. The bad faith, there's no basis in the law under 549.14 to find bad faith for the filing of this petition. And I think I'm out of time.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes to address this.
I hope I've answered the questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Peter Glico on behalf of James Rosso. I'm going to split my time with Ms. McLean. Depending on the court's questions, we're going to refer to Section 2 of the brief, where we've taken issue with the appellant that Mr. Rosso had the authority to remove his sons as trustees, as well as the last argument with respect to attorney's fees and Mr. Rosso's bad faith. It wasn't in the record, and I don't know why counsel has argued this, that somehow the trust was set up by Mr. Cohn so Leroy Rosso could run the businesses without any involvement of his sons. And as long as we've diverted from the record, I think it's important for this court to understand that the businesses, there's threefold, they're all related, they're bus companies. The businesses were not in toto owned by the trusts. Nor is it accurate to say that Craig and James Rosso had not spent many, many years at their mother's side running the businesses. And I think that needs to be made clear to this court given counsel's argument. The trust did not give Mr. Rosso the power or the right or the authority to remove his sons. I agree with counsel that it is the job of this court and was the job of the district court to construe the trust and what the testator's intent was from, and I will use counsel's words, the four corners of the document. The document is not one paragraph. It's the entire trust. And if we look at it that way, and even taking Mr. Cohn's testimony, where he testified allegedly that Ginny did not want her sons to, quote, lord over Leroy, our position is the only one that makes sense and clearly shows her intent. If you take a look at the agreement as a whole, and specifically Article 7, we see in paragraph 7.1, while Jenny's alive, nobody can remove her. That's clear. Then in 7.3, she says, on my death or disability, my two sons are going to succeed me. They're going to take my place. That's what I want. She then directs, while they are trustees, and our position is Leroy didn't have the power to remove them, they certainly could, of their own volition, decline to serve or to resign as trustees. They were directed, that's the word Jenny used, to appoint an independent trustee. Now talk, if the court has any questions about the 2018 order, Your Honor was correct. That stipulated order gave Leroy a right he never had under the trust. He was given a right to participate in the appointment of an independent trustee. And the provision of the stipulated order where he was given that right had no temporal limitation. It's our position that the paragraphs preceding that did have temporal limitations. For as long as the temporary restraining order was in effect, for as long as the case was pending, but that paragraph gave him that right, and he negotiated that right.
What use do we make of that order, though, even the provision with non-temporal when the case is dismissed?
But it's an order, Judge. It's just like if you order me to do something, and once the case is closed, that order is still in effect.
Well, it might be contempt. You're right.
Yes.
But the case is done, and now
it
we
is.
Have a new case, and we're looking at the trust that's never changed itself. And so that's the question I have when we're now interpreting this trust. And we don't issue contempt orders ourselves.
No, I appreciate that.
So how does that work into, or do we need to get to that in terms of the judge's order?
That's really
my more direct question.
Well, my position would be that the order then binds Leroy, whether it's through the trust or through a voluntary stipulated order, and he's bound by that. And he's bound by that in his capacity as a trustee. He signed that order, that stipulated order. He agreed to the terms. He was given a right he never had. And quite frankly, if he hadn't been given that right, I don't think he would have engaged in the shenanigans he did in surreptitiously interviewing an independent trustee, not allowing his sons to even communicate with the independent trustee, and then running into court saying, get rid of my sons as trustees and appoint my independent trustee. This is a man who as a father and as a co-trustee has gone on record saying to his sons and his fellow trustees, I hope your heads blow off. And he's got the temerity to argue there's no bad faith in this action?
Mr. Gleickel, is your argument dependent on a determination by this court that the 2018 order, at least you know that particular provision of it, remains in effect, or do you have an independent argument based on the trust that...
I'm sorry, Your Honor, for interrupting.
I think you know where I'm going, so I'll let you answer.
I do. So the way it has to work this way is he didn't have the power, right, or authority to remove James or Craig. If he did, order or not, and he does it before they appoint an independent trustee, there's no independent trustee per Jenny's wishes that have been appointed by her sons. And I want to get back to my argument. I got off it a bit. 7.3 talks about the appointment of the trustee. 7.4 says, after my death or while I'm disabled, she says there's always going to be an independent trustee. And then you go down to 7.4.3, on which Mr. Rosso bases his claim that he can remove any trustee, his sons or not. Your Honor pointed out our argument, I'm not going to repeat it, with respect to and that it's conjoining the two terms. But then if you also go on, as we've argued, that paragraph goes on to talk about both Leroy, James, and Craig could move the situs of the trust if Leroy ever moved. They would have no power, right, or authority to have a say in the situs of the trust if Leroy could remove them. It makes no sense. And what I want to tell you is they have placed great stock in Mr. Cohn's testimony. It was very conclusory, but the lording over is what they hang their hat on. And let me posit this, because there was a protection of Mr. Rosso from the alleged lording over. The way this is set up is you have an independent trustee, and you have an independent trustee as the guardrail to ensure that the alleged potential lording over would be the subject of an independent trustee weighing in on any action or inaction that if Craig and James were doing what Mr. Cohn said any child might do, you have an independent trustee to mediate or to address that. I see my time is up.
Thank you for your argument.
Good morning. I'm Chelsea McLean with Dorsey and Whitney, representing respondent Craig Rosso. I'm going to address sections 3 and sections 4 of our brief, which concern our position that even if the 2018 order is unenforceable, Leroy would still be in breach of his fiduciary duties under the trust insofar as he removed respondents in bad faith. And then section 4 of our brief concerns our position that he is incorrect, that the court erred in refusing to appoint his independent trustee, given the court had discretion to do this and he had no power to select an independent trustee himself. So with respect to the first point, Leroy's argument, I think as the court has recognized, defies Minnesota law. He argues that Section 7.43 of the trust agreement allows him to remove Craig and James as trustees without any regard to his fiduciary duties, even though he concedes that he is a trustee of the trust and owes fiduciary duties in that capacity. As the district court recognized and this court recognized, my spouse, as used in that provision, is defined to mean Leroy. It's simply a shorthand way to refer to him. As the court also seized on, Leroy doesn't cite any authority whatsoever for his position that while serving as trustee and owing fiduciary duties, he can exercise administrative powers given to him under the trust agreement without any regard for his duty of good faith and loyalty to the trust and the trust beneficiaries. If the court were to adopt Leroy's reading, I think it would be a stunning departure from Minnesota law, which uniformly recognizes that where somebody serves as trustee, they owe fiduciary duties to the trust. If this court were to require courts or parties to trust agreements to parse through each agreement and determine whether a particular term says whether the person is acting as trustee or whether a particular provision falls under a section of the trust labeled fiduciary provisions, I think that would be a problematic exercise, and again, in defiance of decades of Minnesota law.
Ms. McLean, just to confirm then, so you agree 7.4.3 is unambiguous. It gives him the authority to remove any trustee, but he must comply with his fiduciary obligations.
No, I'm arguing this in the alternative. I agree with Mr. Gleickel that in the first instance, this section does not give Lee the power to remove Craig and James. It only applies to an independent trustee.
How do you respond, though, to appellant counsel's point that in answer to Judge Hallbrook's question, my spouse shall have the power to remove any trustee?
I think the subsequent language in that provision where it says independent trustee so removed confirms that any trustee is meant to refer to the independent trustee. But I would defer to Mr. Gleickel's other arguments with respect to the structure of the trust overall.
Wouldn't that require us to add the word independent between any and trustee?
I think the language of the trust is clear. I don't think that's necessary given the totality of that provision, but I also don't think that it even matters because even if he could remove Craig and James as trustee, here, the record is more than adequate to support the district court's factual finding that he did so in bad faith. At the end of the day.
The question, because Gleickel, thank you, made reference to the guardrails, but unfortunately there's been 9 years without a guardrail, and we're still sitting here without the independent trustee, so I'm trying to envision whoever's position we agree with. It seems to me that what moves that off of to actually occur?
Well, there actually has been an independent trustee appointed now.
Oh, there has.
So there is somebody in place now. And as I mentioned, I think there's so many alternative arguments here for the court to fall back on, including the one I'm covering right now, which is that even if he could remove Craig and James, he's done so in bad faith and breach of his fiduciary duties, which I think it would be... again, in defiance of Minnesota law, to say that he doesn't have in regards to this provision. Well,
that render that issue moot for us? You're saying during the pendency of this appeal, the district court has appointed an independent trustee?
That wasn't in the record.
Right.
We did consider making that argument. I think...
Well, whether it's in the record, wouldn't that, as a practical issue, make it a moot? Perhaps in rebuttal, counsel can respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, we think there's no reason for the court to question the district court's rejection of First Trust Company as independent trustee, particularly considering there now is an independent trustee who Mr. Rosso agreed on with the other two respondents.
Thank you.
So with respect to Mr. Cohen's testimony, I don't think there's any indication in the district court's opinion that it actually found the trust agreement to be ambiguous. I think the fair reading of the district court's opinion is that it did not, because it nowhere makes mentions of Mr. Cohen's testimony or relies on it in interpreting the terms of the trust. Rather, the court is very much focused on the plain language of the trust agreement. Even assuming the court did consider that evidence, I think it's plain from the language of the district court's opinion that it gave that testimony zero weight. It's not mentioned once. And it's not surprising, considering if you look at the testimony, it's extremely conclusory. It's 14 years old. He doesn't have any notes or any independent documentation of anything he claims was said 14 years ago after drafting hundreds of trust documents since then. So I don't think there's any reason to bring in that testimony, given that Mr. Degnan himself seems to be emphasizing that the plain language of the trust controls and that the plain language is clear in this case. We agree. There's no real reason to bring it in, and even if it were in, we think it deserves no weight whatsoever for the reasons stated in our brief. As to the second point, that First Trust should not be appointed, I think the court got it exactly right. There's really no universe in which Mr. Rosso is in a position to appoint an independent trustee. At the end of the day, that power either lies with Craig and James, or perhaps if the 2018 order is enforceable with Leroy's cooperation, or it lies with the district court. And the district court was amply justified in rejecting First Trust Company, given the extensive evidence of Mr. Rosso's secretive negotiations with First Trust and exclusion of his co-trustees and, at a minimum, trust beneficiaries from his discussions with First Trust. And I see I have about 30 seconds left, so unless your honors have other questions, I'll step down.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll try to be brief, but of course I'll be happy to answer any questions that may have come up now. I'd refer to several things. Mr. Cohen's testimony is very clear, and it's on pages 40 to 42 of the transcript. We don't need to read it all, but there was a purpose in why Jenny said she wanted to give authority to Lee to remove any trustee, because she didn't want them lording over Lee in the running of the business. And specifically, they did talk about fiduciary duty. She did not want to have that applied to him. That's why they wrote it in my spouse. That's why they put it in Section 7 rather than Section 8. With
you
respect
agree,
to...
You would agree, though, Mr. Degnan, that the district court did not make any reference to Mr. Cohen's testimony in her order?
Well, she did make a reference, and this is
well,
the best part.
She talked about testimony, but...
No, she... But she did address him, and she did recognize him, and, in fact, her finding was that his testimony was, quote, trustworthy, and it's uncontradicted, and it's not appealed. It's not an appeal issue in this case. There's a reason for it, because it was trustworthy, and it gave great insight consistent with the plain wording of the trust.
She ultimately, though, would you agree, did not rely on that testimony?
She chose to rely on the stipulation in 2018 instead, which we believe was clear error, because I think we've already talked about the basis for it. It's gone. It was just like any stipulation. When you're in the middle of a case, you want to have what I'd call kind of a status quo. Okay, for now, you won't remove any of the trustees, et cetera. Then the case gets settled. A release is signed, and that means all claims between all parties are gone. That was signed in January 2019. It's over. It has no impact whatsoever on the trust, and there was no amendment or modification of the trust, as we mentioned earlier. And the part that is most concerning is finding bad faith when, in fact, in the action, there can be not a scintilla of evidence about bad faith for him filing this petition, and asking the court also to appoint an independent trustee. He didn't say, I'm appointing. He's asking her approval or appointment of the trustee, which is what he was supposed to do under the terms of the trust.
But isn't it true, though, that the testimony was, and the court made a reference to it, I believe, in the finding, that his reason for wanting to discharge them was so that he could appoint an independent trustee? Again, basically looking at that agreement in 2018, and now I don't have two people to deal with, I'll just come to the agreement.
Well, she attributes motive, but it's pure speculation. And he could have gotten rid of them because he didn't like the way they parted their hair on the one side of their head. Motive doesn't matter.
But
the terms of the trust do.
From a clear air standpoint, she had a basis in the record to make a finding of bad faith.
I believe she had none. No basis whatsoever in bringing the action. And that's why it's focused on in the action, not for all of the other stuff. Granted, they don't get along, obviously. There's a lot of bad stuff we could just throw in too, but we didn't do that because it's not an issue before this court. There was no bad faith whatsoever in the action, in bringing the action. And I hope I've answered the questions. Otherwise, I don't want to just be repetitive to the court. You've heard plenty in this case, I think. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you all for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to the court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame. This also ends our oral argument session this morning. We will now recess.